Welcome everyone to the Main Street Business Podcast with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen. This is open forum week, the time we get to answer your questions, hopefully on tax, legal topics, building wealth, protecting your assets. Do you want to know who's going to win the Suns-Bucks game? Well, if you've been listening to the podcast, you know you shouldn't be listening to me on sports.
Tanked, man. Oh. Yeah, it's ugly. Well, we're grateful to be here with you. And, you know, we've gotten a few comments that we're going to try to do a balancing act here. We listen to you, our listeners, our viewers on YouTube. And what we're hearing is, guys, we love how you keep it fun. You keep it energetic. These topics are really boring usually, but we're having a good time. And then there's the comment of, hey, can you jump right into the topic and save all your banter for during the show? And I thought, okay, fair enough. So I've got a couple little side notes that I think will be helpful today to keep it light, but I don't want to waste anybody's time. So we're going to be all business initially. Matt, you think that's we can do it? I don't know.
Yeah, I think we should just go straight to it. I mean, like I said, the Suns lost, so I don't even want to talk about that. And let's just start hitting questions, and then we'll, you know, weave in some witty banter or some, we'll bomb some jokes. Either way, you can laugh at that, hopefully.
Yeah. And I want to say thank you to all of you that are catching this show on a regular basis. We've got, I just went to a doctor this morning for a little checkup, and he's like, yeah, I've been listening to your podcast. So I was like, oh, thanks. You know, we're getting more and more listens, more and more views around the country, and we appreciate all of you taking your precious time to listen while you're hopefully multitasking, while you're driving, working out. I just want to say thanks. We work really hard to come up with some good content, and thank you. So yeah, if Matt doesn't say it, I'll say it.
So yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Mark, for saying thank you to everyone else.
Thank you, Matt, for also saying thank you. All right. I'll give you first choice on a question here. Now, for any of you that want to submit questions, what we found over the years, our best method we're finding to be really effective now is rather than bringing on live callers, and it takes a lot of time in editing, sometimes the quality of those calls, meaning our answers as well, can be questionable. So what we found is that if you'd like to submit a question, please go to mainstreetbusiness.com. There's links to our law firm, accounting firm, trust company there. There's a link to sign up for the newsletter, which we do for free every week. Our workshops are also posted there this fall. We got a busy schedule coming up the next 4 months. But there's also a button that says submit a question. So we're pulling from the website, mainstreetbusiness.com, exclusively today. And if you've been posting some questions on YouTube or Facebook, our marketing team will get those to us generally, but not today. I apologize. So get over there to the website. You're going to find that website to be really helpful as well. Yeah. So, all right. Question one, Matt.
Yeah, let's kick it off with Randy Howell from Idaho. Randy says, hello, Matt and Mark. First of all, I want to say thanks for the great information you guys share. I've read Matt's book and have self-directed IRAs with LLCs with Matt's help. Just listen to your podcast on 1031s. Enjoyed the topic. My question is, has to do with a property. I own an LLC that was purchased through a 1031 about 3 years ago. Our real estate market, like a lot of places, is booming, and the value of this property has more than doubled to around $2.5 million. I'm concerned that this situation won't sustain and considering selling during the seller's market. My CPA mentioned that one option could be a deferred sales trust that I can park my money in at a later time, repurchase real estate.
Oh my gosh.
Over time and installments to reduce the capital gains. What are your thoughts on this type of trust? Do you feel it's a prudent move? And do you have a recommendation of companies to work with that set this up?
Okay, I mean, this is the part of the show. You wanted to come out of the
I want to start with a good one.
On this one? Yeah, get some hate mail coming in right away. So, wow.
Well, okay, let me start off, Randy. Love what you're thinking. It looks like you've already 1031 this property once before, so there's a lot of gains built up into it. You're right. We may be at the top of the market. You never know, but it's definitely a seller's market, and you've got a lot of equity, and correspondingly, you'll have a decent tax bill when you sell this property. So everybody wants a strategy, right? And it's interesting because when I was reading this, what I was thinking about is what we talked about a few weeks ago. What does Donald Trump do in this situation? Not that you ever want to be thinking that and apply that to all instances of your life.
Some you may. We've got listeners, viewers from both sides of the aisle.
That's going to be in trouble, man.
WWDTD. Is that it? WWDTD. I got it right. Someone's going to want a shirt with that. So we better. Yeah.
Trademark it right now. What would Jeff Bezos do? What would Warren Buffett do?
All right.
I mean, these people all had highly appreciated assets, just like this, Randy. But they don't want to pay tax on the assets. What I would suggest considering before a deferred sales trust actually is, if you want to get the equity out of this thing, take a loan. Get debt on the property. I mean, that was the whole Trump strategy and the strategy of the wealthy. I mean, that's one of the key things. Bezos, too, as Mark and I talked about in the prior podcast. I mean, if this has $2.5 million value, I don't know what you bought it for. But let's say you got $1 million plus in equity. You could tap that equity to go do something else. I mean, what are you going to do with the cash when you sell it? I don't know. Are you going to reinvest it in something? So, but then you have the upside of still owning the property. And it still can go up in value. I know you may think this is the height of the market, but it'll continue to go up. It might slump a little bit, but over time, it's going to go up. We all know that. It's happened with real estate. So I would first consider not even selling it in the first place. Why? Okay. It's an appreciating asset.
All right. Bold. Not my first response. So that's why you people listen to us, to get different answers. First, let's answer his core question. And then I'm going to give some other alternatives. DST, disturbed sales trust is what I'm going to call it.
Sometimes it is.
Yeah, you know where we're going on this one. Okay, now we piss off a variety of people. And I have read every possible case study, the law, and understand what a deferred sales trust is. Just studied all that on this topic. And so if some of you go, well, Mark, you just don't know what you're talking about. I feel I've got a good feel for these. I believe two feels in that one. Anyway, I really do believe I have a good feel for this deferred sales trust. Yeah. Here's for those of you that don't know how it works, in general, this is where I start to upset people because obviously, Mark, you don't do it. Remember, I'm trying to explain this to an eighth grader. I like to say, okay, here's the example of what this is. You're going to transfer a property or the LLC into a trust that's going to sell the property to a third party that wants to pay $2.5 million. And then this trust is going to create a payout to you over time through an installment sale method, for lack of a better word. It's really a glorified installment sale. And if any of you want to tell me anything differently, I'll say bullcrap. That's really all it is an installment sale over time, deferred sales trust. Get it? You're deferring the gain over time. This is a deferred sales trust, which creates an installment sale. Now, the theory being why is that rather than pay a lot of tax on the initial sale, I can spread it out over time. Now, you still get capital gain treatment, whether you do sell all at once or you sell it over time, but that capital gain can put you into a higher tax bracket if you do it all at once. And I've got a video on YouTube that's really blown up. My team said it kind of has gone viral, and that's an exciting moment. But if you want to just type capital gain Kohler on YouTube, I've got a really good video where I explain the breakpoints of how a capital gain can actually put you in a higher bracket, believe it or not. So I get the point of a deferred sales trust that I want to spread the gain out over time. It's an installment sale that I generate and create with my own trust. Okay. Just don't take a huge commission, people. The people that are selling these, it is unbelievable how much they will charge to do it. And they're like, yeah, but we've done all the research and we've done this and we'll back it up. And the people that I know that hold the proprietary information on their little strategy and they're the ones making the most money, and they hire lawyers to do the actual legal work at a far less fee then they're making who was the brainiacs that came up with this in the first place. And every time I get into it with one of these organizations or promoters, because they hire people that get a huge affiliate fee if they can find someone that does it, everybody's making money on this thing. And you have to do the time value of money saying, how much did I pay for this stupid thing to defer my gain over time? I love it. Defer your gain over time. Just don't charge me thousands of dollars, 2% or 5%, or whatever they're going to charge to do it. My problem with the DST is the cost to implement, not the concept. There you go.
Yeah. My problem with the deferred sales trust is it's super aggressive. I mean, it's not like it's a bright line tax strategy. It's a little bit controversial. Just in concept in and of itself, the IRS doesn't love it. They think it's kind of a sidestep around the rules. And so I would just be careful. The cases that are out there on this, I think there's like a private letter ruling. There's not a lot, but the stuff that's out there is very
conceptual
specific
in nature.
Yeah. And so just be careful. I think it's being oversold, frankly. I think people think, oh, deferred sales trust, I don't have to take any gain until I receive the income, and I'll just pull it when I want it. And yes, we love tax deferral, believe me. But this whole thing with Bezos and all the tax returns and going back to Trump, even just my own real estate, I'm selling a rental property right now. But I'm like, why sell?
Well, why sell? He said it in his question. He goes, I don't know if the market can sustain this level.
I know.
And you're right. The market goes up and down. I think what Matt's saying is, if you're going to hold this property foreseeably for another 10 years, why sell? But if you say, well, I'm going to want to sell no matter what, maybe there's a life event in the near future where you're like, and within the next 5 years, I know I'm going to sell. I have to sell within the next 5 years. Well, cash out now. I get it. But I think, Matt, what you're saying is, if there's no rush to sell this and you're willing to go another 10 years on it, just borrow against it. Is that fair?
Yeah. What I'm saying is, rather than create income, like selling the property is going to create an income tax problem. And now you've got it parked in this trust it's not as easy as you think. It's going to be expensive and it's aggressive in terms of a tax standpoint. Let's just do it the old fashioned, easy way and put debt on it to access that equity. And don't even recognize income at all. And then when your kids inherit the property, they get a step up in basis, no tax at all, as long as Biden doesn't change that. Okay, Randy, that was great question. Deferred sales trust. We did a podcast on it like a year or two ago, I want to say. Yeah. That was just on the deferred sales trust. Just be careful out there.
Okay. I've got a great question from John out in Florida, but I'm going to go to Francisco in Maryland. And one side note, okay, just keeping it fun here. This is an experience that happened yesterday, Matt, kind of puts things in perspective. So we were in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, running the Snake River past Hoback Junction. Matt, I know you've done that stretch. For those that have ever done it, it's called Lunch Counter in Big Kahuna. You haven't done that?
I haven't. No, I haven't.
Oh, wow. Okay, you got to come up and visit, bud. I know a good guide. Yeah.
Okay.
Yours truly, baby. I'll take you down. Back when I was younger, I'd guide. And my kids were a little nervous, so they're like, okay, who's our guide? Me. They're like, squeeze me? Are we ready? We're going to go down the Class 3 Rapids with you at the helm? I'm like, trust me, you know? Anyway, so everything goes well. Near the end of this run, for those that have done it, there's some fun cliff jumping. You kind of take your raft to the side. You scale up the side of this rock crevice, and you can do maybe a 30-foot plus jump. And it's such a beautiful area of the country, too. We saw two bald eagles just perched right alongside the river and green mountains just cascading down to the water's level. It's just so beautiful. Anyway, so we get to this cliff jumping area, and of course, my son-in-laws, who are young and a little more strapping than myself, they, you know, can scurry up this rock face. And Christian, in fact, did he jumped backwards and landed. What do you call that? Not a gainer. Is that a gainer where you jump backwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did a gainer. Backflip into the water. And so I was like, hey, I'm up. I'm going to go, you know. The scary part wasn't the jump. It was getting up this rock face. And this is when my world, you know, came crashing down on me again as I'm getting older. My daughter says, hey, Dad. It wasn't like, hey, Dad, you could do this. You know, you're awesome, Dad. Why don't you go for it? We totally cheer you on. No, it was like, Dad, if you fall down those rocks, it's going to be a pain to carry you out of here. You know, it's going to be a lot of work to put you in the raft and carry you out. It wasn't, Dad, we're worried you might get hurt. It's like, it's going to be a pain in the butt to carry your body out of here. And I was like, I'd hate to inconvenience you. That was her first thought. So, and then I was like, then she felt bad and started laughing, and I didn't jump. I didn't do the jump. I didn't do the jump. No one wanted to carry my body out of there. So,
oh my gosh. All right. Well,
it was pretty sketchy going up this rock, you know?
Okay.
It was all right. So that was, I was worried about
pretty
that.
Pretty like extreme, like Sylvester Stallone and Cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Remember that show? That's a great show, actually.
It is. And yeah, I thought I didn't want to get my arm wedged between two rocks and have to cut it off later, 4 days from now, to get out of there. And
okay.
That's another good one. But okay. Anyway, so wanted to share with some of you getting older, that moment's going to come where you're dealing with your death is more tragic for the family than the death itself. It's just the reality. You got to come to grips with it. It's okay.
All right.
Don't face it. Okay. Now, this is Francisco's question. Hi, team. My name is Frankie from Massachusetts. My wife and I, now I'm going to stick with this real estate question here for a moment. It's kind of in the same vein. It says, my wife and I are W-2 employees with an AGI over 150 grand. We have a two-unit home rental. Oh, sorry. Two-unit home in which we live in and have spent over 65K in upgrades to the home. It sounds like we won't be able to deduct the losses because of our income. Is there a way to use these losses to our advantage anyway? Maybe not file our taxes jointly so that our AGI isn't over 150. Also, what's the best way to use the carry forward losses when we retire? Okay, well, let me add a few fill in the blanks a little bit on Frankie's question for everybody. It sounds like they live in a duplex, and he didn't say it specifically, but I'm going to assume they live in half and they rent out the other half. And so they spent an upgrade, and I'm going to have to make an assumption that they spent that 65 on the home itself. So 32 are kind of for the rental and 32.5 on home. Let's assume that they were fairly distributed over the two units. And what he's complaining, everybody, is that when you have a rental property and rental losses, if your income's 50, you have to carry those losses forward. Now, some people go, well, Mark, you guys preach about real estate and it's a great tax deferred strategy and wealth building strategy that they do. Matt and I buy rentals. And we're not saying all of our investments are in real estate, but I'm just saying it's very common. It's a good overall investment once you get educated on asset class and the geographical area you want to focus on. And so people come to me and go, yeah, my accountant said I don't get a good write-off. I make too much money, so I'm not going to buy rentals. I'm like, whoa. Buying rentals is still a great strategy for a variety of reasons. You're not paying tax until you sell. You're able to leverage your money with a mortgage. You can create cash flow that's tax-free. But the tax write-off can be questionable because if you make too much money, do you lose the write-off? Frankie, you don't lose it. You get to carry it forward for the rest of your life. So that 30 grand-ish that you put into the rental, it may not be 100% write-off anyway, because if it's improvements with fixed attached type assets, you're going to have to depreciate those or include them in the depreciation of the building. I know someone out there is yelling, cost seg. Hey, cost seg doesn't work if you're not a real estate professional. Why go in and cost segregate all these assets and get a bigger write-off when Frankie and his wife are already over 150? So you cost seggers, chill out. So I know that strategy well. I would recommend it if I thought it worked. So Frankie, everybody, Frankie's at. A lot of you are going to buy rentals. And like me, Mark Kohler, I'm not a real estate professional. I still buy rentals and my losses carry forward forever. It's these people that go, well, I'm not writing off travel or home office or electronic kids because I don't get the right. Oh, no, you will. You're just going to get it in the future. So it's a dirt hit, and you'll get it. And the cool part is these losses you're generating on this duplex, you can cash them in when you sell the duplex or when you go buy another rental and sell that one. You can use these losses on the sale of any property. That's big. So I know you're frustrated. You want those write-offs now. Just take comfort in the fact you're going to get to use them. And when they come down the pipe, you're going to love it. Who was the first question, Matt? What was their name?
You remember? That was Randy.
Randy
from Idaho.
And Randy is frustrated because he's like, I don't know if I want to do a 1031 again. I don't know if I want to do an Oz. I may not be able to find a buyer that wants to do an installment sale, and maybe I don't want to carry the paper anyway, and blah, blah. So Randy's, you know, reaching out, like, what could I possibly do? Well, if Randy was sitting on $200,000 or $300,000 in losses that he carried forward from other rentals over the years, he could cash those in. And that plays into the equation. So Frankie, stay the course. You're doing great. Keep buying rentals. Move out of that duplex and make it 100% rental at some point. And buy your next rental as well. Ooh, bumped my camera there. But I like Matt. Any other advice from Frankie? I take it you're probably right on the same page with me.
Yeah. No, I love that. Okay.
All right.
Let me go back to my question. Okay. This is an interesting one from John. I got a similar question like this from a client. So he says, "Hi, Eminem." I guess that's Eminem.
Ooh, man, that sounds pretty hip hoppy.
Yeah. Will the real Mark Kohler please stand up?
Yeah.
Please stand up. Please stand up. Okay. Stand up. All right. So, John, you should know listen to this podcast. You can't start with something like, we're going to get us on a tangent.
It's not going to help. Yeah. We're like squirrels just chasing.
I just prayed and throw a movie quote in here somewhere. Yeah. In this question. It's gonna be.
Well, we could talk about 8 Mile. We could go down 8 Mile. You know.
Okay. But that happened. It's happened. All right, John. Okay. Says I'm in Florida. Binging on their podcast, all kinds of amazing things. Own an LLC with an X selection. I've been surprised at how hard it is to find a competent and knowledgeable accountant. For 2020 taxes, I used a firm that claimed to be the biggest in their state, specialized in small business, owners, PhD, teaches at university, and business 30 years, etc. I found that when they prepared my taxes, they claimed lots of things that seemed questionable to me, like deducting personal health care, sharing ministry contributions as business expenses, and other numbers that didn't add up but were in my favor. I provided them with a very organized spreadsheet of my transactions, and they extracted the conclusions for themselves. Their customer service has been awful, but the numbers are amazing. I signed nothing untrue. I made no misrepresentations. I asked them to correct the obvious errors, but heard nothing back, finding out later that they filed it anyway. Do I have any legal? Yeah. Do I have any legal or ethical liability once a tax prepper has submitted it, or is it all on them? Should I find a new accountant or just accept that they are professionals, have insurance, and I don't need to second guess? Really hoping you can get to this question for me and others in the same quandary. And yes, I had a similar question of a client, pretty successful client, that is like, it's a total mystery to me how I pay no taxes. I have high income, but I sent it to this guy who's been doing my taxes for 20 years. And I'm like, not a CPA, not a tax lawyer, zero credentials. And he just files my tax returns every way. And then the numbers are amazing. I just don't even want to look to see what's wrong. I'm like, okay. Let me answer this for John. Does everyone remember Wesley Snipes? Okay. Pretty famous actor in the 90s, 2000s. Yeah. He went to prison.
You didn't. Yeah.
And it wasn't for a gun crime. Something, you know,
texting and driving, insider trading, nothing.
No. Yeah. None of your typical Hollywood stuff, you know. He went to prison for tax fraud, and he had bozos giving him advice about things he should do on his taxes. And he just said, all right, I mean, I'm really going to have to pay zero taxes. I'm all in. He's like, you're telling me what I want to hear. And you know what happened one day? Someone at the IRS or their system sees a return and says, Wesley Snipes, didn't he just do U.S. Marshals and a ton of other movies this year? Blade 2 or I don't even know. White Men Can't Jump, all these great movies he's in. Really? He makes no money? He has zero income? I mean, like, how is that even possible? Yeah. Anyways, ends up getting audited. The rest is history. Unfortunately, he had to go to prison. Now, these bozo professionals that weren't really professionals, by the way, helping him, had criminal issues themselves. And I don't know what happened to them. Frankly, the news didn't care. But at the end of the day, you do have responsibility. It's your tax return. It's your obligation. You are who the IRS will chase down for money. And if they think you had criminal intent and should have known better, even if you're like, well, but these guys are the professionals, they still need someone to put handcuffs on.
Yeah. Now let's clarify a few things. If, and I like what Matt said, I'll just take it from there and continue carrying the baton around the 400 meter dash. We're going to get hand off the baton a couple times on this one. I can feel it. cool runnings, baby. Okay. Now, so what
That's the that was more of a bobsled. It's like,
John's like, these guys are bozos. I can't even do a decent movie quote. Okay, chariots of fire, whatever. You know, just chill out. Okay, all right. Okay, so here's the thing, John. If they filed your tax return without your approval, now what that usually means is they did it electronically, but you're supposed to file a form and send it to them before they can file it electronically. So it is possible, people, that you may have someone prep your return and you see it, tell them to make changes. And then they say, yeah, we did it. And then you sign the electronic filing authorization and they send it in. So it's very common that you may not even see the final tax return before it goes in. That's normal. But if you told them to change something and they didn't, and they filed it without following your instructions, John, then they are liable for that. Now, it sounds like the firm you went to, they're going to have malpractice. They're credentialed. They're a legitimate firm. They're not in a strip mall like some of these other yahoos. So you're going to have a cause of action if you get audited. Now, I think the safe play at this point is sit back, let the water run under the bridge. If you make it 3 years and there's no audit, and that's 3 years from the date you filed, not that it was due or the year. It's not the 2020 tax return plus three. It's when you filed it plus three. So if you could make it past that point and you were not a contributor or a scienter, or you did not help participate in this little fraud, then you're going to get past 3 years and be fine personally. Now, if you get audited, there's going to be penalties and interest, but you're going to sue these guys and they're going to have to pay it. And that's the way that goes. The criminal part comes into play when if John says, ooh, I like that. You know, cross-sharing ministry should be a freaking write-off. Yeah, let's write that off together. I like it. And you tell them to do it and they do it, you have no cause of action against them. And if it was an intent to defraud the gov, they could pursue criminal action. Now, if you're not Wesley Snipes or there's a lot of zeros involved, they're probably going to pass on the criminal. But there's some heavier penalties they can throw down on you if you try to be a stinker. So I've got some other thoughts, but that's baton number two. All right, Matt. Okay, well, you're on mute, Matt. And I know you didn't like my word stinker, but I was trying to be a little more PG. We got an E rating the other day. I was like, what do we say to get an E rating? You know? So, yeah, so okay. John, if you were a stinker, if you were a little, you know, rascal.
As my grandma would say, if I was, you know, she was mad at me, he's like, quit being a little stinker. I was like, okay. loved her though. But okay. So here's my advice, John. I approach it a little bit different. This is all on you. Sure, you might have some recourse with the professionals, but you know about it. Do something now. Make them amend.
Oh, hold it. Oh, now, Matt, here, I want to say this because Matt's right. The IRS isn't going to care about your excuse. oh, this firm did it without my authorization. Yeah. They told me it was like, they don't care. You're going to pay the freaking IRS. Then you're going to have to go in a cause of action against the accounting firm. It's a two-step process, which is a pain in the butt. It's not like, oh yeah, if the IRS comes knocking, I'll just turn it over to them. Hell no. The IRS is going to care less. This is your return. So I just wanted to add that to Matt. Matt, keep going on your, I like where you're headed.
Yeah. But I think what your accounts are going to say too is, if you didn't feel these numbers are right, why didn't you require us to go amend? And so I have just a little different approach. I'm of the sense of, if you know it's crap, go amend now. Just, you know, now people could say, nah, Matt, I just want to fix things moving forward. I'm not going to do it again. And I'm just going to roll the dice and hope I don't get audited. Okay. I mean, you could do that. I don't love that. And I frankly have had lots of clients over the years that agonize over that and this question. And finally the statute of limitations passed through the audit cycle. And they're like, oh, I just didn't know what to do. And it's hard. I mean, these tax rules are complicated. It can be a lot of money. I get it. But like the peace of mind of just knowing you did it right is really important. And this is one thing I'll say in reaching out to a lot of professionals. You do want someone helping you on tax planning, your legal planning, that's licensed. Are they licensed with a board of accountancy? Are they licensed with a state bar association? Do they have a professional credential that they care about keeping, that they're only going to give the right legit advice, or they have zero credentials, nothing. They have nothing to lose. So they're just going to sell whatever crazy tax strategies they get because that's how they'll get customers. I mean, and a lot of people are like that. They'll tell you what you want to hear, give you what you want. And in the tax game, it can be very scary because it's going to all fall on you. Okay. Sorry, I was getting a little preachy there, I felt.
No, it's okay. And I have one last comment on this because this is a good one, because I want to give all of you out there that are frustrated about finding a good accountant, because we get busy. We cannot take as many clients in our accounting firm as we can in our law firm, because the tax prep process with bookkeeping and multiple returns, that can be 40, 50 hours staff member to work. And we just have hundreds and hundreds of accountants trained to the level that we require to be able to do that. We're trying some new expansion strategies this coming year, but so we feel bad that we cannot take a lot of our clients on the tax because of economies of scale. So now here's what I would say though. First of all, as you noticed in that, Matt's the one that goes and asks mom and dad for permission before at night. I'm the one that sneaks out. I'll take the bruising later. So Matt was a little more of an angel. You know, it's just.
I don't love Matt, but.
Okay. Now, here's what I think all of you need to do. John, by the way, Matt, in John's comment, he said, biggest in their state, specialized in small biz, owners of PhD. Nowhere in there did John say accounting firm, CPA, or law or lawyer. Just because you're a PhD and you open up a shop to do taxes and become a licensed preparer with the IRS, you're going to maybe have a hard time, John, really going after these people in a potential lawsuit. And that's where I would lean to Matt's strategy of maybe ripping off the Band-Aid now, amending and telling them to amend it and making them pay for it. Because 3 years down the road, where are these people going to be? And are you going to have a big enough hammer to hit them over the head with? So, but here, for all of you out there that are dealing with an accountant that you're not stoked about, you're like, Mark, ramp up. We want to be on your wait list. Just get us in. But here's the deal. You are the captain of your ship. I'm sorry. You sign that tax return or the authorization for it to be filed electronically. This means the same thing. Under penalties of perjury, you've reviewed it, you're comfortable with it, and your butt is on the line, period. And I am so grateful for all of you that are listening to this podcast, because you're taking it to the next level going, I want strategies, I want to save taxes, build wealth, but I also don't want to go to jail or get audited and have huge penalties and taxes. I want to be able to sleep at night. So this is so good that you're listening to this, because here's what we generally recommend. Keep a list. We've got our top 10 or top 15 tax strategies. We do it all the time. You're going to find those in our old podcast, especially in December around the end of the year. We're going through our list of hot tax strategies. Hold your accountant accountable. go through them. Say, I want to be doing this, want to be doing this, want to be doing this. And I don't want to be doing that and doing that and doing that because I know those aren't legit. And if they don't do what you say, fire them. It's your return. They work for you. Don't let them push you around. All right.
Okay,
Matt.
All right. Okay. You want me to go next? I got another one.
Yeah. I see this crypto question by Terry. I have a feeling you're going crypto on us for a minute.
Oh, I just did the one right above it. That's also crypto. No. But you want to do Terry's?
Well,
go read Terry's. And I got Matt S. right here after it. It's not Matt Sorensen, but.
Okay. You choose. It's your question.
Okay. All right. Okay. Matt S. says, love the show. Got out of the Navy in 2015. Went to school for a bit. Had a couple kids. Getting a job at the state jail prison. Ended up leaving due to family reasons and had to pull my retirement. I started an LLC and used my personal credit cards and money to fund it. When I get my retirement money, they will always withheld the amount for taxes and really only 35. I wanted to loan my LLC the money I get from my retirement and use that all the business related things from myself so it will be organized for tax write-offs and deductions in one place like QuickBooks. I plan on getting a business account and credit card, but my LLC involves aspects of crypto along with other things banks are scared of because is better than fiat. Wondering if this makes sense, what I'm saying is possible, how to go about it. Okay. There's a lot going on here, actually.
Whew.
So this one.
Yeah, Matt, we got to do some where your head is. Okay. What do you say, Matt?
Okay. Let's start from the beginning here. You started an LLC. You found some personal money and some personal credit cards on some of those expenses. Okay. Track those for the business. Those are going to be business expenses. Now, I said, I want to fund it with my retirement. And it looks like this is your retirement account for your employer that you've just decided to distribute and that they're already withholding taxes on that. And since you're 9.5, have a 10% penalty on top of it. Okay. All right. Now you're going to get the rest of the money. Now, I don't like the loan your own company money. That's not generally what you will do. A lot of people think of it that way. Like, it's money. Loan your company money. Just contribute it into the company. It's like, just put it into the business bank account as an owner contribution and then spend the money out of the LLC for expenses for the business. Your prior stuff you spent personally, that's fine. It was on a personal credit card. It's still a business expense. Just start using the business card moving forward for business expenses. It's easier to track, keeps your asset protection tidier. But don't worry about what you spent personally. Those will still be expenses as long as they were for the business. All right, let me make my last comment on this, Mark, and I'll let you have at it too because there's a lot here. The last thing is on crypto. This is for anyone in the crypto business. We do not recommend putting crypto in the name of your entity, even if you're like providing some type of consulting services or you're just buying and selling crypto with an entity. Banks do have a little bit of a hang up on this for whatever reason. Whether it's what Matt's saying here is they're scared of crypto because it's better than fiat and it could displace the banks to begin with. But one thing we have noticed from clients is if they're doing crypto business is if they put the word crypto or cryptocurrency company name, the banks are like having a heart attack about it. And you end up get some compliance department then asking you a million questions about what the heck you're doing. So I would just leave the word crypto out of your business documents. Don't have it in your name. Don't have it in your business purpose. Maybe just have use something more generic. And usually you'll get a little easier pass with the bank. They're not going to dive into all the crypto stuff you're doing.
All right. I love it. Now, everybody, oh my gosh, I just got chills because I'm really excited about this question and what we're talking about. Now, everybody, I want to go back to the beginning. All right. So Matt gets out of the Navy, hated working at the jail prison, which everybody, I've heard it is so tough. Yeah, I don't know if you know this, Matt, the guy that teaches me Krav, which is, if any of you know, Krav Maga is a self-defense strategy taught in the Israeli army. So my goal bucket list was to be level one certified, and I've made it. So the guy that trains me works in a jail, and he's a cop, and he hates it, just hates it. And he can't wait to get out and start his own business. And we've been talking a lot about that while we're punching the bag. So I get what Matt's up against. Some of you may have a job you just hate, and you're like, how can I start a side hustle, side gig that eventually could supersede my income so I could leave? So Matt does this. He pulls the cord. I usually like to start the business on the side with your spouse or whatever you have to do and try to prove that you can get that business profitable before you quit the day job. So Now, I'm not sure the timing in Matt's question. Everybody keep that in the back of your mind. Number two, he said, I use personal credit cards and cash to start the business. Again, not a big fan of using credit cards to start a business. Dave Ramsey would even be on my side on this one. And he and I part ways once in a while. But credit cards are high interest. Starting a business can be high risk. And if you're using credit cards, you better have a darn good reason to taking that level of risk to start a small business. Then on top of it, Matt, and I know this is water under the bridge. I used this phrase earlier, but you've already done this. So I'm not trying to beat you up. But for anybody out there that's facing kind of a plan like Matt, be cautious. Because he says, I took an early distribution from retirement, penalty and taxes, probably. For most people, that's what happens. And then he's going to put it into his business as well. Matt, you were rolling the dice in some big ways. Not a fan. Now that you're there, you've got the biggest, I think that, and that's not the heart of Matt's question. And regrettably, Matt, those are steps that we would have liked to talk about with you early. But again, the horse is out of the barn and running down the road, or, you know, running through the field. So we got to help you. Here's what my feeling is, Matt, on your question. And I want to come back to a major point for everybody that I think you'll love. My biggest takeaway, Matt, is you got a lot of things going in one freaking entity. Slow down, Tiger. You got crypto. You got a small business. You're trying to write off everything under the sun. You need to segregate a little bit and get a bucket for your small business. What is your business plan? What are you going to make money at? Be really, really clear on that with a strat plan. Then take this crypto, get it out of the business. Crypto should never be in a business. That's going to sit over here and hopefully grow, build, trade it, whatever the hell you're going to do with it. That has nothing to do with the business. You need to hyper-focus on your business goals, entity, keep it clean, get some coaching, some support, some help, and really make that successful. And you've taken some risks here where you're going to be staying up on some late nights, bud, because you might fail at this. So now, I've never said business owners fail. Business owners fail to be flexible. So it's okay if you change the business model. That's not failure. So be willing to change your pricing, your product, your service. Turn it upside down if you have to. That's not failure. Giving up is failure. So you stick with it, bud, and you can make it.
Yeah, I think we're always going to be fans of the side hustle, you know, working it while keeping your day job. It helps you not have to use revenue from the business just to live off of. I mean, you got to nurture this thing. These little small businesses, right when you start them, they're babies and they need you to do everything for them and they give you nothing back. I mean, they're not going to even clean their own room. But then they'd be turned into toddlers and they can run around and break stuff and that costs you more money. You know, so there's this life cycle of a small business. But then as it grows and it becomes, you know, it can do a lot of things for itself. And I mean, just think of all that stuff and the value that happens in a small business, but takes money on the front end and takes a lot of time. And I think the side hustle is the best way to do it. So, yeah. Okay.
Right. My question, but I'm going to pose one back to you, Matt. Is that okay?
Okay. All right.
Go ahead. Read Matt S. I'm going to read Terry. Now, this is a short, fast question. Terry says, if I take a crypto loan to buy rental real estate, I'm going to ask Matt to comment on what a crypto loan is and the variations of that. And is it smart or wise or whatever? So Matt, that's where I need you because I don't understand that as well as you do. But Terry takes a loan against his crypto. Think of it kind of like in this sense, Terry, I'm going to say you have a paid off vehicle in your driveway that might be worth 10 grand. And you go out and get a title loan against that vehicle. And you're going to go buy real estate with the loan proceeds. Okay. So that's what he's doing, people. Now, to buy real estate, it may have been not a $10,000 jalopy in the front yard. Matt will talk about the crypto piece of this. But Terry borrows money against his crypto asset. And let's say he borrows $50,000 and he's going to use that $50,000 to go buy a rental property. Love it. Love it. And he asks, can I deduct the interest payments back to the loan just like I can with the HELOC? Now, when he says HELOC, I'm assuming Terry is getting a home equity line of credit against his own home. That's where they're most common. But let's just look at this more broadly. Whether it's a title loan for that jalopy in the front yard, a HELOC against your primary residence, a loan against your crypto, if you're paying interest to a lender for money you're using in a business, it could even be not rental property, just your business, those interest payments are 100% tax deductible because you're using that money to create income. It's a code section 62 of the IRS, and it's like any other loan, like a credit line at the bank or whatever. So, Terry, yes, you better write off that freaking interest. Matt, what do you think of these crypto loans? Give us some variations. You've said before they can be really risky, yes and no. Is this where DeFi comes in? And I just get confused.
Yeah, so I just on this question, just think of it, if you got a loan, period, doesn't matter what the asset was behind the loan. Like Mark says, it's the title loan, it's your personal residence, it's your crypto, it's your baseball card collection. That's just what the loan's secured against. Right. That's just the collateral that you're putting up for the lender to be willing to loan you, because they can go after that collateral if you don't pay them back. But if you get debt, period, and you use it to buy real estate that's rental, you're going to be able to deduct that those interest payments. Now, crypto loans have been popular. A lot of people who have bought a lot of crypto or had an increase in value, or for instance, are like, all right, I don't want to sell this. How do I access again the value of this asset and use the money without having to sell it? Sure, you could do a loan. Here's the scary part that I'm like a little concerned about on these loans is in the crypto loan scenario, you're actually loaning them the crypto, right?
Now, is this where they're paying you money? So you're loaning someone
money. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't borrow a loan as crypto as collateral. So correct. Two different scenarios. Okay. Before you go there, how many places, I guess there's a lot, where I could give my crypto as collateral for a loan?
So remember, like when we're talking here, we're talking about like you're the lender now. Like just like you have cash and you want to loan to someone, you're like, oh, I have Bitcoin. I want to loan it to someone. Not like I want to take a loan against my crypto and I'm the borrower now, like Terry was asking, you know. But now it is, I own crypto, Bitcoin, let's say, and Mark wants to loan me to loan him 2 Bitcoin. And he's going to pay me back 2 Bitcoin plus interest. Just like if I loan him 200 grand, he's going to pay me back the 200 grand plus interest. So those are these crypto loans that they're doing. A lot of the major exchanges have them. Gemini has it, who we work with quite a bit on our IRAs. Coinbase has it. Lots of places are doing these now. It's been a really big part of the business. I've read into the details on them and they scare me a little bit. Because I even looked at doing it myself and I was like, I don't know. Because what you're doing is you're just loaning an LLC money. The LLC is, you're lending them your crypto. Like they have your crypto now. And they're going to pay you back that crypto plus some interest, but maybe they don't. They're just an LLC. These companies doing it. It's not like these aren't like a CD that's federally insured. This isn't a bank paying you a money market. This is like just XYZ Investment LLC that's smarter in crypto than you. And so loan us your crypto and we're going to pay you back interest and your crypto or not. You know, if we don't, then we don't. And you have no collateral. Like they didn't put up anything to get your crypto. So, and you're not like, by the way, like Gemini, for example, like, or even all the exchanges, you're not lending to those companies. It's a third party. That's the actual borrower on these. It's not like these big exchanges that you might feel comfortable about because they're large and have tons of insurance and assets.
Can you explain where staking falls into the world of crypto in this topic for those that don't know?
Well, staking is different because that's like you're putting up crypto to the exchange, really, or not to the exchange, to the network, to whatever crypto network it is. And so it's like a mining process of validating transactions and uncovering new crypto that can be, put into the circulation, so to speak, of that of that network. So staking is basically more like mining. You are putting up your crypto though as part of it. There's a process of that, so you have to own that crypto to stake it. But the crypto
not as risky,
is very different. Not as risky because it's like it's not gone to anybody. You know, it's in the network. It's not like it went to XYZ LLC that held it. You know.
Okay. Well, I like it, Matt. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good questions. I like that, Terry. So crypto loaning or crypto borrowing. See, they're two different things, everybody. And then staking. Make sure you understand every one of those dynamics really well before you jump in the pool. You want to, if you don't see how deep the water is, oh, this was on the river this week. If you can't see how deep the water is, you don't jump in at first.
Uh-huh. Right?
Is that deep? That's deep. that's like investing.
Is that a pun? I don't know.
That's a life lesson. Damn it.
Oh, I thought you used the word deep. If you can't see how deep the water is, and then you said that's deep.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know. No pun intended.
You walked into it. You had a great pun.
I did. I had a good analogy going there. But no, everybody think about it. You know, hopefully your parents. So I had a good friend about 20 years ago that was paralyzed from the waist down for jumping into a lake head first, hit a log. But isn't that really interesting? That concept of don't jump into a lake or a river. We were on the Snake River and this was earlier in the week. Another guide said, never jump into the river unless you can see the bottom and you know how deep the water is. And in investing, how many people jump headfirst into investments and they don't really understand where the bottom is or how deep the water is? Oh, man, I got it. That's another article. I got to write that down. How deep the water is. Okay. Now, I've got one more question and then maybe you can choose one, Matt, if you want. Okay.
Yeah, I got one more too. Fire away. Okay. If you're ready.
We've been answering guy questions for some reason. And I know we have more female listeners than guys. So ladies, I want to tell you, speak up. You're the silent majority here. We love you ladies. And it helps mine and Matt's ego a little bit. Okay. So Joanne says, I'm in California. I'm an S corporation leasing my office space. Okay. Wish I had known about both of you sooner. Now see, that makes me feel so good. I just feel better today. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Joanne. All right. So then she says, I sublet some of the rooms in my office, funds in my personal checking account. I signed the office lease 4 years before becoming an S corp. Now that last little bit throws me off a little bit. Joanne says funds in my personal checking account. So I guess she's taking the rent from these people and just throwing it in a personal account.
And she personally has the lease because she had the lease before she had her S corp.
Yep. That's part of it. I like it. You're reading into it. Then she says, question, should I have my sub letters pay rent to my S corp versus me? If not, is this rent considered passive? The answer briefly is no and yes. You should not have the subs pay, well, she says, versus S corp versus me. I want the subs to pay your S corp. Even though your S corp wasn't around when you signed the lease, you need to treat it like that. That's the asset protection benefit. Even if the lease isn't in the S corp name, you want to do everything you can to keep it. Treat it as if it was in the S corp name. You may even be able to reach out to your landlord and go, hey, I've set up an S corp since. I'll still personally guarantee the loan, the lease. Will you allow me to transfer the lease to my S corp? And you could play the guys that is for tax purposes. My accountant wants to see the lease in the name of the S corp. Now, you can still write off the lease payments if it's not in your S corp name. But why would we want it in the S corp name? Well, think asset protection first and foremost. You're going to get the write off anyway. Before we get to these subletters, you're going to get the write-off. But let's make sure if there's a slip and fall, an employee accident, that your S corp is the tenant, not you personally. So that's a big deal. So I may reach out to the landlord, try to get that lease transferred. You're still going to personally guarantee it, but it doesn't make you personally liable for a cause of action. It just puts you on personally liable for the lease payments if you default. So it's a good asset protection move. Now with the subs, you sublet. That's great. That's going to help defer your cost to stay in there. But who's the sublet? Okay, who's the tenant? You, and you have a subletter, third party. They need to pay the tenant, which is the S corp. So you're not the tenant. The S corp is. You guys know what I'm saying. I think I may have said something wrong there. But the S corp is the tenant. Let the subs pay the S corp. So is that going to jack up your payroll matrix? Nope. You're all good. Your payroll matrix is based on your draws from earned income. The passive income from these tenants is going to be on a separate line on the K-1. The accountants will be able to move it around. I've even seen some accountants take the subletting and just offset your lease. So it's kind of a contra account. You accountants out there, we call it a contra account, where when the subletters pay their rent, we're just reducing the rent you paid. So we don't even claim it as income. We just reduce the expense of you paying a lease to the landlord. And I don't have a problem with that either. So Joanne, I like where your head is. You're on the right track. It's passive. Reduce the expense. Get that lease changed into the S Corp. And I think you're doing great. Thanks for the comments.
Cool. Yeah. I like that. Okay. I had Mark. You answered a Matt question, so I'm going to answer a Mark question. Who does say love the program, Mark and Co. Mark, I want to let you know, I almost didn't read your question because you did that at the beginning there.
All right. Fair enough.
He said, I want to claim the real estate professional on my personal tax return. Don't we all, Mark? Don't we all? He says, I'm a W-2 employee and my wife is not. Between the two of us, we meet the requirements. Can we claim it? She does feel like she is, quote unquote, a professional. Thanks and keep up the great work. Okay. So let's go through this, Mark.
Why don't you give the why? You be the why. This makes sense. I can say the how or whatever. You choose the
why. We all want to be a real estate professional. That's what I joked at the first, Mark, is because if you have rental real estate losses, for any of you that have rental properties, you can use all those losses to offset your ordinary income. So let's say Mark can get his wife to be considered a real estate professional under the rules. Then as a married couple, all of their rental real estate losses can go and offset his W-2 income, which could be huge.
That's the goal.
We love that. Now, she really has to be a real estate professional. And Mark could go into that and all the hours and such. So we love the strategy. And a lot of people are like, but Matt, I can offset my rental income already against my ordinary income. Okay, that's if you're an active real estate investor and you're making like $150,000 or less a year, you can maybe get away with that. But once you're higher income, you can't take your real estate losses to offset your ordinary income, your W-2, your small business. Your rental real estate losses are going to get carried forward into other real estate gains and used later, as Mark talked about at the beginning of the show. Don't worry, those losses are going to offset future gains of real estate. But the creme de la creme, like the real prize here, is kind of use those losses now against like W-2 income or small business income. That's what's awesome.
Yeah. Now I may even want to step a little further back here. Mark G. A lot of people come into a consultation with our tax lawyers or accountants or get on a show and ask, how do I become a real estate professional? Now, everybody step back for a minute. A lot of times people are making the assumption that it's always the right time to be a real estate professional. Like that's, like Matt said, the prize. I got to do it. Well, let's think here. What happens if Mark G and his wife don't even have any rentals yet? Does he need to be a real estate professional?
Yeah.
No. I have people come in and go, I need to be a real estate professional. I'm like, oh my gosh, tell me about all your rentals. We have one. Oh, okay. How much in the losses? You know? So don't think that being a real estate professional is for everybody. First requirement is you better have a bunch of rental real estate generating losses, which they will if you're leveraged and yada, yada. Okay. Number two, Matt said this, how much is your income? Mark, my second question would be, how many rentals do you have and what's your AGI? And he goes, well, I make $100,000 on a W-2. Well, you get to write off all of your rental losses up to $25,000 worth. How many rental losses do you have? 20. We're done. You don't need to be a real estate professional. So again, you want to look at how many rentals you have and what's your AGI to see even if being a real estate professional is something you want to try to go after. Now, to qualify. In a married couple, we love it because it gives us a little more latitude. You cannot combine your time. You cannot combine the services and you cannot combine your, I guess, occupation. One of you has to be in real estate full time or at least 20 hours a week with nothing else superseding that. So if Mark, you got a W-2 and your wife's like, I don't have a W-2. Well, is she spending at least 750 hours a year doing real estate? She doesn't have to be a licensed realtor. She doesn't have to be a contractor, but she better be out there fixing and flipping or managing rentals to show she's burning 750 hours a year. And since she doesn't have another job, it's going to be easy for her to claim that's her primary occupation. But if your wife, Mark, is a pharmacist 20 hours a week, or she has another small business, you may say, oh, she's an interior designer. She has a little Schedule C. It could be a problem. Or look at how much time she's spending there.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are some additional thoughts. What do you think, man? Bring us home on that one. I don't know if I covered everything you wanted to.
Yeah, I think for those, and I think, Mark, we presume you're asking because you do have higher income and you've got the rental real estate losses. That's where the real estate professional designation is awesome. And remember, if one spouse qualifies, both of you qualify. And for any of you single people out there that have high income, go find yourself a real estate professional, you know, to help you with your rental real estate losses. Could change your tax life.
Yeah. Well, one last little story from Jackson Hole yesterday, if I may, Matt.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I thought it was funny. It's just kind of a little interesting quip. Okay. You know, I know some people have a lot going on in their life. They need a little fun. So here's a little. Okay. So after we ran the river, we go into Jackson. Now, for those of you that watch Yellowstone, the TV show or series on Prime, there's a lot of. Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of people out there that have learned that Jackson Hole is not a town of millionaires anymore. It's a town of billionaires. They've pushed out the millionaires. So it's pretty bougie. So we're cruising around, and now I pride myself in being, I'm trying to be the millionaire next door. I don't dress that flashy. It's hard for me to go buy a new pair of shoes or something. I know a pair of jeans that's $300. I just can't do it. I try to be a little Warren Buffett, you know, drive the Ford F-150. I don't need a brand new expensive
car.
Eat
a Dairy Queen, you know.
Yeah, I love Dairy Queen.
Out for date nights at Dairy Queen or.
Yeah. Someone says, let's go out for seafood. I'm like, Arctic Circle? I'm in.
Fish and chips?
I love Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
Ooh, fish and chips at Arctic Circle? You know, I was thinking more of Mastro's or Ruth Chris. No, I'm at Arctic Circle. You know, they got a 3 halibut plate. Okay. Anyway, so we're walking through Jackson, and I'm grateful. My kids are they're good looking. I mean, I don't know where you know my wife or I don't know if they got it from us. Probably a gene pool way back in the generations of Europe, but they turned out okay. And they can dress. And even my daughter, she buys a lot of her clothes at secondhand store, but she's just trendy. Anyway, they walk into this. Yeah, they're hip. So we're shopping around, and these stores are like artsy, and there's furniture stores. We walked into this furniture store, and there's a chair. I'm like, well, I could maybe buy this chair. I mean, it's just a plain looking chair. It wasn't like a Lazy Boy or leather chair. It's just a chair.
Oh my gosh.
$7,500. Wooden chair. $7,500. I'm like, wow. It wasn't, or Brookstone massage chair, nothing like that. It's just a wooden chair, $7,500. I'm like, oh my gosh. So, but my kids, they look so good. It's funny. Yeah, go ahead.
I say it's like the fridges. Brian Regan, this fridge, $800, keeps your food cold. This one, $1,000, keeps your food cold. It's like a chair. This chair, you can sit on it. $7,500. This chair.
Go to Target.
$20.
Yeah. So we go to the store, and I'm not getting any attention. You know, they're like, this bozo's not buying anything. You know, looks they're kind of like, can we help you out? Are you lost? My daughter and her boyfriend, my daughter that's single was with us, and her boyfriend, they're just a good looking couple. Like, he's got long hair, he's ripped. Sydney's long legs, blonde. They're just good looking. She's wearing cutoff jeans and cowboy boots, which is totally Jackson, right? Some girl comes up and goes, I got to ask because I just – seriously, I'm not lying. Girl walks up and goes, I got to ask because I just don't want to miss out. Are you guys famous? They didn't ask me this. They asked Sydney and her boyfriend, they're like, are you famous? And they're like – no, you know, because they're like, where are you from? Oh, we're from California. Blah, blah, blah. They're like, if you've been on the Kardashians, whatever. So they're just good looking, you know, whatever. I know. But with me, they're like, can we get you to leave? You're kind of bringing down the clientele ever. You know?
Sir, we don't have a public restroom. No.
Are you looking for a public restroom? It's down the street, you nut. Yeah. So anyway, it was classic because at the end of the experience, I get out of the store because I'm not going to buy a chair for $7,500. That was their low end. And another manager came over to my daughter and boyfriend. They're like, you know what? We can set up a private appointment for you guys. Would you like to come back tomorrow? We'll shut down the store for you. What are these billionaire kids? You know, these 1%ers that have kids that just run around with black cards, you know? And Sydney's like, oh, thank you so much. And she goes, here's my personal card if you'd like to set up an appointment. You know, I didn't get jack squat. You know, like,
wow.
I was walking out the door and the door kind of hit me on the way out. You know, it's just like, what? You know?
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm proud of that. Okay. I don't need to go out and buy bougie stuff to feel important. I was good. So,
okay.
But it was a little demoralizing. But here's the moral of the story, people.
Okay.
Spending money. I got a moral. I got a moral of the story.
Okay.
Moral of the story is, I'm changing lives here, bud. Okay. The moral of the story is, you don't have to spend money. You don't have to be rich or bougie to be happy. And it's not, I would argue it's not worth it. It's not worth chasing it. It's superficial. Now, if you're good looking enough, like Matt Sorensen, he's got the look. He could pull it off, you know. He could walk in and they'd roll out the red carpet. But if you've got the look and you want to take advantage, there's a little extra profiling where it helps you out. I get profiled the other direction. Matt gets profiled, the bougie profile.
Right.
I'm going to call that the bougie profile. But anyway, but the point is, everybody, when you're building your business, when you're building wealth, do it to put money in the bank for the scarcity, for the times when it's going to be tougher. For the future, so that you don't have to work as hard. You don't know what your health is going to be like in the future. You don't know what your family, your parents, your kids might need. You might be the one solid resource in your family that holds it together financially at times. And if you're out there buying the most expensive car and $7,500 chairs, you're not going to be that person. And I think when you're going to work your butt off to build a business, let's take that profit and put it away. Let's build it. Let's save it. Some of my flashier clients that are holding workshops, they don't like that. They're like, I bought a Lamborghini and it's so cool. And everybody, all the millennials just, you know, flock to me, you know. It's kind of that Grant Cardone crap. And I love Grant. He's been on the show and I've been on his. But, you know, it's not me.
Yeah.
That's okay. Be yourself. Do what you want. But I'm just saying my opinion.
Yeah. Do what makes you happy. If buying something cool makes you happy, that's great. But I also want some people to have some financial security. And I probably say one of the biggest mistakes of people that have success is they buy those things. They don't pay the IRS. They don't pay down their debt. And then they're in this vicious cycle of never being ahead, always owing the IRS, end up getting chased down, have creditors chasing them. And they have all these things they blew their money on. And we've just seen lots of business owners, unfortunately, make mistakes. And then their stress level's high and now they're out of control. You know, they're out of control and there's not a lot of satisfaction and enjoyment in that at all. So, but I thought, you know, from your example there, I thought what your takeaway was going to be is we're starting a new company to sell chairs. That's where I thought you were going. $7,500. We're in the wrong business. I mean, you know, we each see something and get something different out of it. It's like, you know, a certain book. People can read a book and take something different from it. Maybe I'm, my brain's in the wrong place.
Nah.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. And thanks for everybody throwing in the questions at mainstreetbusiness.com. If you didn't like what we were talking about, please throw a question in there at mainstreetbusiness.com. For those of you we didn't get to, we did kind of skip some questions. Sometimes they're a little more specific. I know we got some of these that are still up here from the last couple podcast episodes, but please get in there, mainstreetbusiness.com, submit your question. We do these every few weeks. If you've got IRA related questions,
maybe do more. Maybe we should do more.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the IRA questions we don't answer here.
Yeah, we do those at the Directed IRA podcast. If you got IRA, retirement account, self-directing, building your Roth, using a solo K, drop those over at the Directed IRA podcast. You can submit questions there, and we hit those in that open form. And thanks for being with us, everybody. We'll be back next week.
Thanks.
With another amazing episode.
Have a bougie week, everybody. I love that word.
Okay. Bougie. All right. Thanks, everybody.